Horizons, the meeting ground of spirituality and society, religion and culture.
Welcome to Expanding Horizons. I'm Jane Brooks.
I'm Clive Brooks.
2009 marks the bicentenary of the birth of Charles Darwin. 2009 also marks the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species on the 24th of November 1859. Our topic for today is, therefore, evolution by natural selection. Charles Darwin was born in Shrewsbury, England, on the 12th of February 1809. His parents were Unitarians, so Charles was taken to a Unitarian church in Shrewsbury as a child. However, he attended a Church of England school, except while he was 8 years old. His wife also came from a Unitarian family, the Wedgwoods. No doubt Darwin was profoundly influenced by Unitarian philosophy, but as an adult, he described himself as an agnostic.
On New Year's Eve 2008, The Australian reprinted an article from The Times by Simon Barnes. He wrote that Darwin's book shattered a vast collection of cherished myths. The truths he showed us are so difficult to consider that we still haven't got around to taking them on board. Instead, we have created a new mythology to cover up the gaping hole Darwin has left in our species' pride.
2009 marks the 400th anniversary of another myth-shattering event, the time Galileo turned his telescope towards the heavens. He found evidence for Copernicus's heliocentric theory, which displaced Earth from the centre of the universe. 250 years later, Darwin showed us that humans were just another species of animal.
Simon Barnes suggests that one way some people have coped with this is to accept that evolution exists, but to perceive it as a ladder leading to a supreme animal.
Others cope by saying that Darwin's theory of evolution is simply wrong. Some people are convinced that life on Earth is the result of intelligent design by a supernatural creator.
Barnes points out that there is no goal for evolution other than the one ambition of all living things, that is, to become an ancestor. Rather than being like a ladder, evolution is more like a bush. Everything living now is equally triumphant, Barnes wrote.
We tend to think of the platypus as being somehow less evolved than other mammalian species because it lays eggs. But it's probably no more like its ancestors of millions of years ago than we are like our ancestors of that long ago. Modern day creatures are all the products of millions of years of evolution. All of today's species are survivors, even though some are hanging on only by a thread. More importantly, our ancestors all were able to reproduce. Our friend Margaret James, an experienced biology lecturer at TAFE, told me about a champion bull that won every prize it could concerning its coat, health, body structure, and so on. It appeared to be the fittest of its kind, but it turned out to be sterile. Evolution is not just about survival of the fittest. It is about reproducing, becoming an ancestor. And sometimes survival involves cooperation rather than fierce competition. There are many examples of animals helping each other. You can find them by googling altruism in animals. Some people think this altruism disproves Darwin's theory, but natural selection is still working in instances of survival of the nicest.
Being the most fit to become an ancestor is not the same thing as being physically the strongest. Thinking fittest, always equals strongest, is a common misconception about natural selection. Another misconception is that evolution has never been observed, at least not in the sense that one species has been seen to give birth to another. It appears that some people want as proof that evolution happens, an event, like a cow giving birth to a previously unknown species. If that ever happened, it would be strong evidence against the theory of evolution. Usually, it takes many generations for natural selection to produce a new species. But in creatures like fruit flies, which reach sexual maturity in as little as 1 week, many generations can occur over humans' working life. If you Google the Talk Origins archive, you can see quite a long list of speciation events that have been observed and documented.
Yes, but don't expect the species to be dramatically different from each other. There is a lot of debate about how to define what constitutes a species, but one definition that applies to sexually reproducing organisms is a breeding community. And a breeding community is one which produces fertile offspring. We know lions and tigers, for example, can interbreed in captivity and produce live young, but the tigons or ligers are always sterile. If the hybrids could reproduce, then lions and tigers wouldn't be separate species. They would be variants of one species of large cat. It's amazing how much variation can occur within one species. We only have to look at dogs. Theoretically, a Chihuahua could breed with a Great Dane. It would require artificial insemination and the female to be the Great Dane so she could survive the gestation process. However, it would be very cruel to carry out such an experiment because the puppies would most likely be an incompatible mixture of characteristics of their parents. I suppose these two breeds of dog are not considered separate species because some puppies resulting from such unethical interbreeding, if it was ever tried, may just happen to be viable and able to reproduce.
This speculation makes us realise that deciding when a speciation event has occurred is not simple. This is why there is still debate over the definition of the word species. What causes variation within a species? Mostly sexual reproduction. In the process of meiosis, through which gametes, sperms and egg cells are produced, there is a large amount of random shuffling of genetic material. There are millions of possible combinations in gametes from one parent individual. Each gamete is unique. Even more variation is made possible because there is genetic input from two parent individuals during fertilisation of an egg cell. Mutations are rare and are usually harmful. In Darwin's time, nothing was known about DNA and genetics. He observed the variation, but did not know what caused it. The full title of his book was originally On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. He described how the selection process has led to speciation. It was the natural selection that really upset his contemporaries because most of them believed all species were specifically designed and created by God in 6 days. According to Darwin's theory, evolution is a very slow process involving gradual changes in populations over millions of years. The changes are caused by some members being better survivors and breeders than others.
Well, there has been criticism of this traditional aspect of Darwinian theory because rather than showing a series of gradual changes, the fossil record shows evolution tends to be characterised by long periods of standstill or equilibrium where nothing changes much, punctuated by episodes of very fast development of new forms. This theory, proposed by Niles, Eldridge and Stephen J. Gould, is known as the punctuated equilibrium theory. We know from geological history that sometimes there have been catastrophic and sudden changes to Earth's biosphere caused by such events as volcanic eruptions and large asteroid impacts. At such times, many species have become extinct, and those which could survive in the radically changed environment just happen to already possess the characteristics enabling them to do so. Evolution is about change rather than progress.
Another misconception about evolutionary theory is that it is wrong because a fossil record doesn't contain any transitional species. The punctuated equilibrium theory was formulated because gradual changes from one species to another have not been observed.
Well, the fossil record does contain at least one transitional species, Archaeopteryx. This is the most primitive bird known, and it lived 150 to 145 million years ago. These fossils show evidence these creatures had feathers, but these animals also had teeth and a tail. They had more in common with dinosaurs than modern birds. However, it's another misconception to expect the fossil record to provide the best evidence for the theory of evolution. Not all species have been fossilised. It takes a special set of conditions for fossilisation to occur, and they certainly did not occur all over the Earth during all of the time there has been life on Earth. Some species may have been only partially fossilised, and we now know that some changes were catastrophically abrupt rather than gradual. But having a lot of gaps in the fossil record doesn't mean that natural selection was not operating. It would have had an even greater effect after a catastrophe. However, since the fossil record is so incomplete, molecular biology is a much better way of finding evidence for the theory of evolution.
We've all heard about DNA, and most of us have also heard that it is a very long chain of molecules in the shape of a double helix. We've probably also seen a diagram illustrating the molecular structure discovered by Nobel Prize winners Watson and Crick. A diagram of DNA looks a bit like a twisted ladder or a circular staircase. The sides of the ladder are alternating sugar and phosphate molecules, and the rungs are pairs of molecules known as bases, which are connected by hydrogen bonds.
There are four different kinds of bases, commonly known by the first letter of their names, A, G, C and T. A can only combine with T, and G can only combine with C. This means there can only be four kinds of rungs in a DNA molecule, AT, TA, GC and CG. But they don't have to come in that order in any given DNA molecule. They can be put into any sequence, and this is how we get so many different genes. There can be hundreds of these paired bases in a single gene. When a cell divides, the whole DNA molecular chain unzips down the middle and new bases form bonds with each half of the original to make duplicates of the original. This copying process is not perfect. Sometimes mistakes or mutations occur. And this is how genes or the genetic code can be altered. These mutations can be passed on to an individual's progeny.
But as I've said, mutation isn't the prime cause of variation within a species. Most mutations are harmful, and the organisms inheriting such genes don't survive, let alone reproduce. Our friend Margaret James pointed out that the power generator for variation is sexual reproduction. Each new individual will receive half its genes, that is, half its DNA, from one parent and half from the other. This gene combination generates an enormous number of possible characteristics an individual can inherit. There is, therefore, a great variety for natural selection to work on. When there is a catastrophic change in the environment, with a lot of variation in a population, there is a greater likelihood that there will be at least some individuals with the characteristics that will enable them to survive. Sometimes, however, no members of a species will survive a catastrophic change. Following the impact of an asteroid with Earth 65 million years ago, most species of dinosaurs, including the mighty Tyrannosaurus rex, became extinct. However, Some puny little dinosaur species that happened to have sufficient warmth provided by feathers became the ancestors of birds.
And this leads to another misconception about evolution, and that is that existing species are at some kind of pinnacle of perfection because they're still around. It was a surprise to me to find out that not all DNA is useful genetic code. Apparently, over the millions of years we've been evolving, we've accumulated a lot of DNA which doesn't appear to be code for anything. Only a small proportion of an individual's DNA is functioning genes, which are producing proteins. Also, there's a lot of redundancy, with several copies of some genes. We've inherited a lot of what appears to be junk DNA. We can't really know if it's functional in any way. Now, that doesn't sound like perfection to me. However, being able to survive and reproduce doesn't require perfection.
Whether you believe living things are the result of natural selection or of God's creativity, it isn't hard to find examples of biology which don't appear to be a really good design. One example is the mammalian retina. It's inside out. The nerve cells are in front of the light-sensitive cells, so that to get through to the brain, the optic nerve has to dive through the retina, causing mammals to have a blind spot. We managed despite the blind spot, but it would be better designed to have the retina in front of the nerve cells.
Another example is the pharynx. This is the passage at the back of the throat, which is common to the digestive system and our respiratory tract. Now, we've all had the experience of food going down the wrong way, and a person can choke to death when food has blocked their trachea. Perhaps it would be better designed to have no connection between the esophagus and the trachea. Except, how would we survive having a bad cold if we couldn't breathe through our mouth? Perhaps that's why the pharynx was naturally selected for.
Wouldn't there be much less risk of infection if the organs of reproduction didn't pass through a toxic waste disposal area? I can't guess why that arrangement hasn't been selected against. However, animals don't have to be at the pinnacle of good design. They just have to be good enough for sufficient numbers of a species to have become ancestors, resulting in a viable population. To be viable, a population needs a big enough gene pool to ensure its offspring can also become ancestors. Natural selection can only work with what already exists. It can't start all over again with a new design when disaster strikes. It's too late then.
In one of his books, Professor Paul Davies wrote, "Our bodies sit atop a family tree festooned with genetic disasters." Unquote. Of course, the really big genetic disasters resulted at least in failure to reproduce and usually in the death of the affected individuals. However, Paul Davies' comment reinforces the notion that, like any animal species, Homo sapiens is not perfect. We're going to have a music break now, and then we'll take a look at social implications of the theory of evolution.
You're listening to Expanding Horizons with Clive and Jane on Radio Adelaide 101.5 FM. We've been talking about Darwin's theory of evolution by means of natural selection, which certainly produced a great deal of turbulence 150 years ago. It still does, because of its social implications. It was a huge shock to the human psyche to be presented with the idea that we are just another species of animal rather than being at the pinnacle of God's creation. Many people still believe Darwin's theory is wrong, and species are the result of intelligent design. Ironically, even greater turbulence has been created by people who embraced Darwin's theory too enthusiastically.
The misconception about survival of the fittest being survival of the strongest led to the philosophy known as social Darwinism and policies of eugenics. I found through an encyclopedia website called kids.net.au that in 1857, Herbert Spencer wrote a book titled Progress, Its Law and Cause. He talked openly about race and class and even had a ranking system for cultures. We've already said evolution is not a ladder. Darwin's theory doesn't support the notion of unidirectional progress, but that didn't stop people using the theory to justify notions such as it being white man's burden to take over what they saw as more primitive cultures in order to help them progress.
According to that website, Spencer's work revived Malthus's idea that in order to stop a human population from outgrowing its food supply, it was natural and therefore morally justifiable to allow the weakest to starve. Darwin herself did not assume that the existence of natural selection implied it was morally right to encourage it. Apart from that, as we have already said, sometimes those who are best equipped to pass on their genes do so through some kind of cooperative behaviour.
A long time ago, I read Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene. It was published in 1976. Dawkins wasn't claiming genes had any conscious will, but back then he took the gene-centric view that those genes that are passed on have consequences for the creature possessing them that lead to their own replication. Dawkins saw organisms as being survival machines for genes, and DeWitt described this as a chicken being an egg's way of making more eggs. But taking an organism-centric view, which Dawkins apparently now does, genes are seen as a blueprint for making more organisms. However, his earlier idea could be an explanation for why we have so much junk DNA.
Molecular biologists now know that rather than having a single major function, most genes play a part in lots of tasks. This may explain why genes for Huntington's disease haven't been selected out. It must be that there is some benefit to carriers of these genes. Or perhaps it is because usually the awful consequences of that condition appear later in life, after a sufferer has become apparent. It is now possible for people to have tests for such a genetic disorder. If they are carriers, they can receive counselling about whether or not to have children. How deleterious does a genetic problem need to be before counselling should be given? Where do you draw the line? We've all got genetic disorders of some kind, usually masked by a functioning gene.
Well, thinking about genetic disorders such as Huntington's disease raises the question about whether or not there are some people who should be physically prevented from breeding. Advances in medical technology have enabled people who once would never have survived to adulthood to become parents, and often their children would inherit a severe disability. Will this have negative consequences for the human genome? There are also people who have the physical capacity to reproduce, but who would not be able to understand the process of reproduction, pregnancy, or giving birth. They'd not be able to care for children or understand counselling. And as far as I'm aware, it's now regarded as an infringement of human rights to carry out compulsory sterilisation under any circumstances. But there must be cases where it would be very cruel not to at least use reversible contraceptive methods of preventing a pregnancy from occurring. But some people think even contraception is wrong. So I don't think we'll go any further down this track because it leads to such a moral minefield. It certainly appears that the theory of evolution and natural selection does not provide a good basis for ethics.
We have already mentioned that there are people who believe Darwin's theory of evolution is simply wrong. It is not possible to prove or disprove the existence of God, but any scientific theory, if it is indeed a scientific theory rather than a belief, should be disprovable. We have already said that the existence of altruistic animals doesn't disprove Darwin's theory. As far as we're aware, none of the arguments put forward by creationists to disprove have convinced biologists. But what sort of evidence would convince biologists that evolutionary theory had been proven wrong?
According to an article by Michael LePage in New Scientist, 16th of April 2008, finding something like mammals with feathers or rabbit fossils in the Precambrian time before multicellular creatures existed, would disprove Darwin's theory. Nothing ever so dramatically out of place has been found in the fossil record. LePage writes, quote, "It is quite hard to imagine what life would be like if it had not evolved. There are animals with a mixture of mammalian and reptilian features, such as echidnas, and fossils with a mixture of bird and reptilian features, such as the toothy Archaeopteryx. However, no animals have a mixture of mammalian and bird features. This is just what is expected if birds and mammals evolved from separate groups of reptiles. There's no reason why an intelligent designer would not have mixed up features, such as creating mammals with feathers and deficient bird-like lungs, or furry breastfeeding ostriches." End quote.
It is true that the theory of evolution is not proven. It would only take the discovery of a couple of examples of really out-of-place creatures like feathery mammals to disprove it. But there's a great deal of evidence in the fossil record, and especially in molecular biology, for the theory.
You said a few moments ago that it's not possible to disprove the existence of God. So accepting Darwin's theory doesn't mean you have to deny the existence of God, but it probably would affect your concept of God. I said earlier that biology was not a good basis for ethics. Being another species of animal doesn't excuse us from all moral responsibility. We can still have a special place in the web of existence because of our capacity for such responsibility. Being an animal doesn't have to be seen as a demotion for humanity. Sam Barnes ended his article, Father of Evolution, reprinted from the Times in the Australian, with these words: "Me, I cherish my kinship with the wild world, feel honoured to be a species among millions, and am greatly the richer for realising this." Far from feeling that Darwin's truth makes the world a bleak and depressing place, I believe with Darwin that there is a grandeur in this view of life.
That's all from Expanding Horizons today.
Expanding Horizons is produced in the studios of Radio Adelaide by members and friends of the Unitarian Church of South Australia. For more information about Unitarianism, please visit our website, adelaideunitarians.org.au.
Radio Adelaide is a community radio station that believes in diversity. Having plenty of diversity makes our society more adaptable. It's a bit like having a large gene pool. Our station needs your financial support to provide you with a diverse range of programs to choose from. If you're not already a subscriber, then please consider becoming one. It will only cost you a dollar a week, or half that if you're on concession. Telephone 8303 5000 for more information.